Hello and welcome to The Correspondent. My name is Jared Watt, and I find myself in a slightly secret location, not far from Bert's lounge downstairs here at the FCC. With me is my colleague and journalist Governor Zella Chin. This time is to introduce a special episode marking this year's International Women's Day. Hey Zella, welcome back to the mic.
Hey Jared, nice to be back. We're about to hear a panel discussion we recorded next door as part of the Hong Kong International Literary Festival. It was me and two other journalists, Jervina Lau and Caitlin Liu, speaking on a panel discussion about our essays in the book, The Stories Women Journalists Tell.
Now, Zella, I was that kind of nerd, that kind of literature festival goer who buys the book and asks for it to be signed afterwards by the panel members. Now, the three of you are among 22 journalists across Southeast Asia who contributed to this book.
That's right. And the panel's moderated by another one of our FCC members, Anasuya Sanyal. She's had a ton of experience in broadcast journalism across Southeast Asia over the last 20 years. This was a conversation that was intense at times, but I think we cover a lot of interesting and relevant topics.
I got a lot out of this, Zella. Thank you. And thanks to Jervina and Caitlin. And of course, thanks to Anasuya. We'll take it from here.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our panelists. I wanted to start by talking about all of your contributions to the book and to the anthology. And Jervina, I'd like to start with you. So you lived in Hong Kong at two very different parts of your life, and both were marked with great change for the city. Can you please tell us a little bit about this?
Thank you, Nasuya. Well, the first time was intentional. The second time was inadvertent. The first time was in 1997. I came here with AFP for the handover. And then the second time was in 2019. I came with my family. I was no longer working as a journalist. And we all know what happened in 2019. So that's inadvertent.
And one of the things that struck me when I read your piece, particularly about the 1997 part, was you were determined to be here to cover the handover. And you talked about what it was like being a younger female, I think, reporter slash editor in the newsroom. What would you kind of tell yourself now, if you could go back in time, what would you do that was different during that stint than you did at the time?
I would probably tell myself to calm down. Because back then, there was this push to, I think a lot of young female journalists feel this. There's this urge that compels you to do better. I mean, I suppose it's not just with journalists. I suppose most women feel this when you're in a male-dominated industry, that you have to do better than the men. You know, so there's this push that you have to be better. So you have to show up and you have to work harder and you just have to be good.
I think you said you needed to be chased out of the newsroom to leave. Would you leave on time?
No.
If you could do it again?
No. But then I think it's Asian work ethic. It's, you know, we're expected to be there early and leave late. So I think it's true for a lot of workers in Asia, especially Japanese workers who practically die on their desks. So.
Thank you. Zella, I wanted to ask you about your piece and your contribution, which was very striking. You know, now that we are post-pandemic, finally, what you wrote about in the anthology were stories of people you reported on who were kind of forgotten during this time where all of us had lots of issues to deal with during the pandemic, and it was called Poverty in the Time of COVID. Could you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Yeah, so for my station, I did this piece about poverty, and it was at first year of the pandemic in 2020. And if you remember at the time, we were all quite scared, right? We're all scrambling to get masks. The restaurants were shut at 6 o'clock. And then I did this piece about poverty and I interviewed poor people, and it really got a strong reaction from my friends, actually, and from people who saw it on TV. We had people writing in and wanting to give jobs to some of the interviewees that I had on my show. And I think it was very meaningful because, I mean, poverty, the pandemic, it's very relatable, right? We're all going through that. And this piece was like, but you think about, were we really thinking about other people? Maybe not, right? We're all considering and thinking, oh my gosh, what do I do? How do I handle my virtual learning? How do I do that? Like, I know a lot of my friends were concerned about whether or not they had enough bandwidth at home, right? So each child could have a laptop set up for virtual learning. But the people I was interviewing, they were living in subdivided flats. They lived in like 50 square foot flat. And this one lady, a single mom and her daughter, was in accelerated courses. She was a great student, but once she went to virtual learning, she didn't have a laptop. She was trying to learn on her smartphone, and she would miss a lot of things, you know? And people saw that, and they offered her a computer, and they offered the mom a job, and it really touched a lot of people.
And do you know how she's doing now? Have you kept up with her?
I don't know how she's doing. I do know how one of the other families is doing. And they are an ethnic minority family. So from Pakistan, the father came when he was a young boy. So he went to primary school in Hong Kong. So he considered himself one of the lucky ones because he could read, he could write in Chinese. But at the beginning of the pandemic, he lost his truck driving job. And he was grateful to do freelance work. Picking up fruit at the wholesale market and distributing it and sending that to the retail networks on the overnight shift. And I remember when I interviewed him, he was really scared about getting injured, right? Because it's back-breaking work. And then once the story went out, I followed up with him, I called him, and he had like slipped and broken his leg. Yeah. And I mean, it's a working class family, right? And their son, he grew up here, born and raised here, had excellent grades, excellent in Cantonese. That's really hard, right? And I just had a chat with them recently. The parents are now in Pakistan because they had a family emergency. So they're there for like, they've been there for half a year. The son, he finished his university schooling. That was a touch and go because he had to raise money to pay his tuition at that time. So he managed to finish, but he's looking for a full-time job. So now he has an application with the Correctional Services Department. He's going through the background check, and he's doing part-time jobs while that's being done. Yeah. So hopefully that family will, you know, have their dream of being lifted out of poverty.
Yeah. Thank you. Caitlin, I'd like to go to you. The title of your piece in the anthology is called The Motel Editor. And I wasn't aware that motels had editors. Can you tell us what that refers to?
When I was trying to decide what to write for this anthology, I thought it would be interesting to write an origin story. How I became an editor, what got me interested in editing, and I realized that my first editing job, and I was paid for this, was actually not working on my university newspaper. I was paid at the time, but it actually predated that when my parents were immigrants. My parents owned a small business, and my parents, especially my father's English, was atrocious. And even though I was an immigrant child too, like many immigrant children, my English surpassed that of my parents in short order. And when I was about 11 years old or so, my father tapped me to write and to edit for him. And so my father's English was terrible. His first language was actually German, but his second language was Chinese. And he's only received schooling in Chinese. And so I think his life experiences, it was just a mishmash, and he couldn't spell. The grammar was sometimes reversed, maybe because of the German. And so when I was 11 years old or so, I took one of my father's, he had to write a reply to a letter from the city government over something that, an accusation that his business needed to comply with something or had broken a rule about something, the finer details of which I have already forgotten. But I do remember my dad had this handwritten sheet with words crossed out, and I had to put those words in the proper order to convey what it was that he wanted to say in a way that the audience, which was a city government of El Centro, California, needed to understand. And I typed it out for him on a home typewriter. This is how long ago this was. I just carbon dated myself, huh?
It's okay, it happens.
And it wasn't just that. It was that the business that my parents owned was a motel. It was a very small motel, 18 rooms plus four apartments, and everything needed to be done. And it was my family. So my parents were the motel managers and the motel maid and the motel plumber and the motel handyman. And I was, you know, I folded towels, I helped water the plants in the garden, and I did, in short order, pretty much all the writing and editing for my parents for their business needs.
Just out of curiosity, how much did you get paid? Or were you paid in, like, M&Ms? Or
funny enough, you know, my parents never paid me for that. I would get a dime.
Classic Asian parents.
I did get paid for other tasks. I got paid a dime, which is 10 cents, 10 U.S. cents, for one round of watering plants. And I would get a dime, and after a few years, I got a raise to a quarter for washing dishes.
Great. Kept pace with inflation. Maybe they could see that you loved it, that you loved the editing, writing, that you were, that was something that you were into. And, you know, we don't need to be paid for things that are not necessarily for things that we're passionate about.
Yeah, I'm not sure, yeah. Actually. My parents didn't, they were actually super relaxed for Asian parents. And my father was only half Asian, but he did spend all his childhood in China and then Taiwan. They weren't your stereotypical Asian parents who put a lot of pressure on kids. And I felt at a very early age I needed to help my, and this is probably true of many or all immigrant children, I needed to do all that I can to help my parents survive. Because my survival depended on their survival. So I was very happy to help.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me in your piece was that, you know, you start excelling academically. You go to some of the most elite universities in America and some of the most elite newsrooms. And there's still a part of you who's that 11-year-old, and you're like, I can never be open about how I actually got my start. Would you be more open about that now, do you think, when we are all, you know, origin stories are a thing and, like, uniqueness in your background is a thing?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly open about it now. I've never lied about my background, but it wasn't something that came up in conversation. Usually when people ask you where you're from, they don't mean which house did you grow up in, because I didn't grow up in a house. I grew up in a succession of motels in different places. So it's usually what city you grew up in, what state or country you grew up in. So it just never came up in conversation in the past.
And are they satisfied when you say California?
I usually say Southern California. Sometimes I say rural Southern California.
Yeah. Sometimes you get, where are you really from? Because they're asking something a bit different.
And then I have to say Taiwan.
And then they say
a whole different story.
And then they say Thailand. I love Thailand. I've been there. I wanted to ask you, Jervina, and you, Zella, where and how did you get your starts?
During my time, I don't know if it's still the same now, given the change in land, in the landscape. But during my time, when you wanted to break into the news industry, there was the easy way and the long way. No, the fast way and the long way. The long way is you start as an intern and then you rise up the ranks, reporter, and then what, editor, then columnist, and then you just go up the ranks. That takes a long time. The quick way is the risky way, which is you go to a conflict zone, normally without backing, so that means you're freelancing, and then you get to, you pick up other, I mean, you report for other news or media organizations, and then you hope they make you full-time, or you do really well and they make you full-time, and you're in. And you're a big name, like Lara Logan. I did it the second way. For me, what I did was I had gone to California, to LA, and I did my journalism degree in UCLA, and then I interned in, back then it was UPI. And the UPI bureau chief in LA was good friends with the UPI bureau chief in Manila. Yeah, nepotism. And so when I went back to me, because I was thinking, what am I doing in California? Well, I mean, what am I doing in LA? What kind of stories am I doing here? Disney princesses and okay, the most hard hitting is Skid Row. But that's about it. Whereas if I went back home to Manila back then, it was right after the EDSA revolution. It was Aquino, who had just become president, and there was a succession of coup d'etats. So it was a conflict zone. So I figured if I went home, I would definitely be able to handle, to cover more hard-hitting news, and I can make my name. And that's what I did. I went back to Manila. I went straight to the UPI bureau, and he hired me in the strength of his connection to the LA bureau chief, and that's how I got my start.
So, when I was in university, like many students in the U.S., they're trying to figure out what they want to do with their lives. So I think freshman year, I went to see my career counselor, and she laughed at me because usually she doesn't see them until senior year. But every year I would do an internship in something I was interested in, like maybe working in an NGO or working in marketing. And then the summer before my senior year, I had an internship in journalism in Hong Kong, which I really loved. So it was, I felt the profession was about telling the truth and trying to get things right. And we try to do the right thing, and we're letting people know what's happening out there, so we're educating people. So I thought that was a very important role in society. So I went back senior year looking for jobs in journalism, and based on my interests at the time, I was studying Russian and Chinese. Alumni would say, oh, you really have to go to CNN International because that's a good fit for you based on your interests. So I went to a journalism conference by the Asian American Journalists Association and their professional journalist network, and they have a job fair, and that's where I met the CNN recruiter who subsequently hired me, and then very shortly after, they sent me to Hong Kong, which is where my mother's from, so I kind of always wanted to be in Hong Kong. So back to the origin story.
I'm going to stay with you, okay. Bella. How did it feel for all of you to write about yourselves for this book rather than telling stories about others, which I know is your comfort zone?
Oh, that was really hard, actually. I think it's a different skill set. I'm definitely more used to talking about other people. And it required several really tough rewrites. I think when I pitched my story, I knew it had touched a lot of people because I posted about my story on social media. I had friends from other countries who really enjoyed it. And I had people in Hong Kong who watched and said their wives were crying because it really touched them so much. So I pitched it knowing that it was going to be a good story. But the editor came back saying, oh, no, this is good for a news story, but it's not good for a personal story about yourself. So I really had to dig deep and rewrite it all, actually. It took a couple of rewrites to get there, yeah.
For me, it wasn't hard at all. So when I was at the Los Angeles Times, I'd written first-person narratives for the travel section, and that was just a really interesting and fun thing to do. But long before that, when I was in high school, even before that, I was a prolific writer in the first person, just for myself and for my friends. I kept a diary even when I was, I don't know why, nobody, maybe I learned about
it's
it.
It's like the XX chromosomes make us keep a diary.
I kept a diary when I was in elementary school. In junior high, I started, of course, this was before there was social media. My friends would pass notes. We would pass notes to each other, but these weren't like one little paragraph notes. We would write, especially in the most boring classes, letters to each other, one page, two pages. And when I got older in high school, it was pen pals. I had several pen pals going, just writing, you know, the longest letters. And you try to be interesting when you write to, even if it's an audience of one. And so I've been doing it a while.
I think I'm somewhere in between Zella and Caitlin. I'm a text writer, or previously known as a print writer. So writing is normally what I've always done. But this was difficult in the sense that it was personal. So when I sent my first draft, the editor came back and said, yeah, but where are you in the story? So I had to rewrite the entire thing and insert me in the stories, which is a little unsettling because it's not something that, as a journalist, you're accustomed to. You're trained to be objective. You're trained not to be the... You're not the news. Something else is the news, not you. You're just supposed to bear witness to the news. So that shift was a bit odd. It actually felt very modern. Because I sort of thought, okay, what's this now? Like a podcast is talking about me. So that was a change.
Understood. A very broad question. We could talk about this for the rest of the time we have together. But I would really love to hear your thoughts about the state of journalism at this moment, in general, in the region, as female journalists.
Okay. Actually, I had wanted to offer some positive comments because journalism... Okay, I was expecting you guys to do a broad overview, but I can do this. So I guess with journalism now, right, you do see a lot of layoffs happening and restructuring. My station, too, we're not immune to that. But I did want to offer some bright points about this because I do see companies that are expanding. Like NBC has put more people here in Hong Kong. CNBC, during the pandemic, grew their China bureaus. And I was completely surprised, but it's happening. I actually recently met with a woman who... On Friday, I was filming, and she is in PR. I was filming at the Convention Center affair. There, a trade show over there. And she had worked at ATV, which is a TV station that closed 10 years ago, right? And then after that, she went into PR, did events, which is a very normal profession to transition to. And actually, she said to me that she felt that she was protected by her media company, which I thought was surprising, and I probed her about it. And she said that because when she was in media, she would just go out and do her stories, but whereas being in PR and event space, she really was subjective to the business at the time, right? The last couple of years, there have not been any events. There haven't been any conventions. Virtual events don't replace that. So she was, you know, it was touch and go for the last couple of years. So it was really... surprised that she said that. And in terms of the state of the media, I remember at my current station sitting in management meetings maybe just a year or two ago. And I find that in media, there's a lot of women in media, right? There are a ton of women there. I would say 80% of the newsroom is female, and maybe just 20% are men, but at the upper echelons, it's male. So sitting in that management meeting, I was thinking, it's like 50-50 male-female ratio, right? And so women have, and I see it too, people get married and they don't want to do the evening shifts. They want to go home and be with their husband, right? So I think some women drop out of the workforce because of that. But I've noticed there's change. The last time I was in the meeting, there were more women there because, well, in the past year, we've restructured. One of my male bosses has retired. Another male boss, very senior gentleman, left as part of the restructuring. So, yeah, there are more women in those management positions.
My view is more doom and gloom. Journalism is in trouble. I think that's the overall big picture. Most of my data will come from North America because I think North America keeps more data on such things. But in the last 20 years or so, over 2,000 newspapers across America, mostly small, medium-sized cities, have closed. Over the last 20, 25 years, the news industry used to be a $50 billion business in terms of revenues. Now it's more like $10 billion. The question is what to do about it. And I'm not sure that anyone has the answer. Certainly some of the smartest minds, not just in the room, but in the world, some of the most successful people in the world don't have it figured out yet. There are bright spots. The New York Times is profitable. The Boston Globe is profitable. But, you know, the Los Angeles Times just had another round of massive layoffs, and it's currently being helmed by a brilliant billionaire man. And there's just no end in sight.
I know that when we discussed having this panel, it was important to you, and I think it's important to ask, knowing there's no easy answer, what can we do as individuals, what can we do collectively to help protect and save journalism? You mentioned billionaires, and this is something that comes up at home with my husband, who's a journalist, where it's like billionaires buy media companies as their little toys. It's like their football team. It's not a given that a billionaire is going to save the day. And I see you, Gervina, wanting to say something. So please.
They buy it because it's their PR company. That's happened like forever. In the Philippines, you see a lot of local tycoons buying up newspapers. And that's because the newspapers serve as their PR for their company until they get into trouble with the government. That has happened, actually, in the past. And in answer to your previous question, I think it depends on what kind of news. I think news has become very fragmented. Previously, you have them all in one umbrella. Now you don't. If you're talking business news, yes, it's profitable. If you're talking arts and entertainment, oh, definitely, even more so. Although entertainment, maybe because of TikTok and a lot of the celebrities, for instance, are able now to manage their own image. So you've got Instagram. So maybe not as profitable as it used to be. But when it comes to general news, that has not been profitable for a very long time. Reuters, for instance, the business section of Reuters has always subsidized their news section. AFP is partly subsidized by the French government. AP is subsidized by all the newspapers. UPI is gone, it's dead and buried. What are the other? The other big media companies are owned by billionaires. Who can afford to probably throw money at it? But otherwise, news itself, I think, it's sad because people don't want to pay for news. And it's important, it's necessary, because people need to know. So more and more, I think it will have to become a public service. The question is whether the government or the people are willing to pay for it, if it's going to be a public service. And more for journalists who cover general news, it's becoming more of a vocation, because the pay isn't really good. So, and I mean, for instance, to my shock, I was just speaking to a friend who's a journalist, and I was told that the salary of a news company now compared to 20 years ago is lower. And I was completely surprised, given inflation, you know. So if you're a young upcoming journalist, how are you going to live? So
yes,
it makes it very difficult. And actually, even the title journalist, if you go to LinkedIn and you type journalist as a job that you want to enter, what are you going to see? You're going to see a lot of companies, consumer companies, looking for journalists. And you're like, why would Nabisco want a journalist? Or why would Samsung want a journalist? It's marketing. That's what it is. What they want are content creators, because that's the skill.
Yeah.
Another skill of journalism. Or they think it's journalism.
Yeah. I wanted to stay on this. What advice would you give someone who is probably like the way you were, the way we all were, who they just couldn't think of anything else but breaking into journalism and being a reporter? What advice would you give to somebody like that now?
Journalism is two things, or several things. If you break down the skill, one, the main skill is news gathering. The second skill is writing, or with broadcast writing and speaking, right? News gathering, almost everybody or nobody can do it, because that is hard to do, actually, and it's hard to do right. That can also get you into trouble. The writing part is sort of easy, because that's a skill. But that's also something that more and more you see AI being used. So the hard part there is really the news gathering. So what I would say to a young journalist now is to think very well, you know, what part of the business you want to break into. And just see. Maybe try it out for a bit, because, you know, it's a rewarding industry. It's really rewarding. There is nothing compared to the thrill of watching history being made in front of you, or being a witness to history. There is nothing like it. But of course, unfortunately, the rewards are not as great as it used to be before. But still, people do chase it. I mean, I'm sure now if you go to Ukraine and you go to Israel or Lebanon, you will see a lot of stringers. Stringers are journalists who just go there, again, without backing. You know, if a bomb explodes in front of them, sorry, they're just dead. But they do it because, as I said, there is nothing better than watching history in front of you.
I'm idealistic, but I'm also pragmatic. If I had to give advice to a young journalist or an aspiring journalist, especially someone who's still in school, I would say do not major in journalism. The faculty of most journalism schools are fabulous, and there's a lot that you can learn from them, but you don't have to major in it. You could take all the journalism classes you want. Where you really learn journalism is on the job, through your university paper, through internships or apprenticeships, through freelancing. There's only so much you can learn from a classroom. And the journalism degree is also not going to help you get a job. Journalism grads, I'm sorry to say, are a dime a dozen. Sure, there are lots of journalism grads who get jobs, journalism jobs. There are lots of journalism grads who don't get journalism jobs, and they end up in marketing or PR, in advocacy, non-journalism areas. So if you're not a journalism major and you want to become a journalist, as long as you have the hands-on experiences and the portfolio of work, that makes you stand out. If you're an econ major, imagine if you were a science major, and that might also move you up more quickly down the line. You might start off as a general assignment reporter, but then you quickly move into a specialist role as a science journalist or as a science editor. If you're already in journalism and it's too late to change your major, I would have a plan B. Journalism is not do or die. It's a very important profession. A lot of people wish they could be doing it, but unfortunately, the pie is very small and it's shrinking. And I would be pragmatic about it and have a plan B. And even if you think you have a really secure position, that might not be the case 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, if you're a long ways from retiring. I will share with you a horror story. One of my former colleagues got laid off. He was very successful at his job, but that's just the unfortunate economics of the profession. He got laid off in a round of layoffs. He had written a book, and he was considered very successful, but he got laid off. He tried freelancing. He didn't get enough freelancing jobs, or he didn't have enough high-paying freelancing jobs to equal what he made before. He started falling behind in his bills. His house was going into foreclosure. He had a kid, he had a wife. He committed suicide. Why? Why doesn't he get another job? It's hard, but don't do what my former colleague did. And find yourself a plan B or C.
So my advice would be to be flexible, similar to what you're saying, I guess. If you're an aspiring journalist, it helps to have the other skills as well, right? If you have legal training, wow, you'd be great covering the elections right now in the U.S. with all the cases against Mr. Trump, right? Or if you're a science journalist, there's a lot of need out there for journalists and people who have the skills. Like Jervina was saying, a lot of jobs out there require good writing skills on LinkedIn. And I actually am a big proponent of journalism. I'm still very happy with it. I'm very passionate about it. I've done some great projects. I have, you know, I get to have the nice life. I don't have to do my evening shifts. I've grown out of that. And in my downtime, I actually spend a lot of time at the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm a journalist governor over there. So we're having a journalism conference May 4th. And that is geared towards young journalists to help them learn the skills and meet editors who might be interested in their work and hire them. I actually had heard of this really great story from one of our fellows, which is a fellowship given to young journalists with 3 years of experience, and she got her current job at SCMP because somebody told her future boss about her. Somebody at SCMP was looking, and somebody said, hey, why don't you consider this fellow? And her boss approached her. So that's amazing, right? There are a lot of organizations out there to support young journalists, like the Asian American Journalists Association. So I would say reach out to those organizations. There are a lot of lovely ladies here who've moved on from journalism and have very interesting careers, but are still very supportive of us in journalism.
Yeah, there is life after journalism. I was joking a bit when we got to know each other. When I started at ABC News in New York, hoping one day to be on the air, I felt like there was only really one path, and it was like the Diane Sawyer path. It was like the blonde, blue-eyed beauty queen path, and that was not available to me. I wanted to ask you, what's different now for an Asian female journalist? Every news organization, every organization has scrambled to diversify. DE&I, we hear it all the time. Has it been effective? Does it bring true change? Someone mentioned recently at an AmCham event I was at that you always hear about the business case for diversity and it helps with decision making. They were not necessarily positively stating that, but what are your thoughts? Do you feel like the push for diversity is for diversity's sake, or is it really...
I think it's really good to have women or diverse voices, particularly in journalism. You want diverse voices. You want different truths. You want different experiences. And that's necessary. So I think, like, for instance, during my time, okay, talking about carbon dating, I'm carbon dating myself as well. When I was, you know, much younger, as a young journalist, there were very few women. Now there are so many more women and women bureau chiefs. That didn't used to happen when I was a young journalist. It was difficult for women to be, particularly in my line, because I was in general news and conflict reporting. That was hard. I mean, I remember... Well, I was working, I was asking my boss, I want to go to Serbia. And they were like, what? What are you going to do? Ski over a landmine? Or things like I said, Timor-Leste, I want to do that. It was happening back then. And they were like, no, you stay in the desk. But now...
Well, what was your response to that? I want to pick this apart a bit.
Just which one?
When they said ski over a landmine, when they said stay at your desk, you can't... They basically were telling you, you're a woman, you can't possibly...
Well, there were two things. I was a woman. Secondly, you need seniority. So, okay, the woman part I was disgruntled with, but the seniority, all right, I sort of understood. Also because I had an Australian colleague who said, don't be upset, Gervino, I'm Australian. Do you think I don't want to go to Timor-Leste? This is my dream job for ages. And they wouldn't let me go. So I'm like, okay, fine. There are things that you just accept. However, now when I went to the AAJA conference, I was surprised to see a lot of women journalists in high positions. The New York Times bureau chief in Southeast Asia is female and Singaporean. The Washington Post bureau chief is also female. During my time when I was starting out, it was really tough to see. They weren't even... sending out local journalists, meaning to say only white males were sent to different countries. And like, for instance, I'll give you an example. The AP Bureau in Manila is always a white male as bureau chief. The writers were white males. The news gatherers, because they needed to be able to speak the local language, were the locals. Now, I think about 10, 15 years ago, that changed. All of a sudden, they were sending the locals all over the region. They opened it, particularly the photojournalists, because the landscape has changed, the money has changed, it was cheaper to get the locals to go around the region and reporting rather than parachuting them from Washington or wherever the bureau, the headquarters was. So that actually is good because it gives you a different flavor. There's a, you know, it's good because it opens up, I mean, it allows, first it's good because it allows the locals to see the region and to, and it widens their experience. And at the same time, it gives a different flavor, a more Asian flavor. It's like an Asian covering Asia, not a Westerner covering Asia, you see. So that makes it so much more interesting. Or like the Aung San Suu Kyi issue in Burma, the last when she was still the leader, they sent locals around the region, Malaysians, Singaporeans, and I think Indians, to cover that news. And so it's a different mindset, and it's a different thinking.
Yeah, I could see that in maybe news judgment. You know, what a local reporter would feel as a story may not be accepted as such if there's somebody above them or without context. I mean, do you think that, I'll open it up to both of you, do you think that could fly today? Could somebody actually say to a female reporter, you can't do that, it's too dangerous? Or would that be like a one-way ticket to HR?
I think it really depends. If you're sending off a woman reporter to India, there are parts of India that aren't safe for regular travelers, women or men, especially women. So I don't think it would be sexist to at least have a conversation, maybe a more intensive conversation with a woman journalist as opposed to a male journalist about, so she's completely aware of the risks that she would be putting herself into. But I think for a lot of the rest of the world, it is a very different place, and HR may not allow such questions.
So we have about 10 minutes left. I would like to open the questions up to the audience. I'll take a few. Yes. Okay. So the question is, why hasn't there been different Me Too movements in Asian markets, specifically in Hong Kong? Oh, stories being broken.
So I produce a lot of women. Not a lot, actually. I've done a few. And I remember when I started in the in this particular newsroom, I remember asking a colleague, remember we have a lot of females on the team, right? I asked a colleague, hey, are women paid less here than men? Because you hear about this all the time in the West, right? And she's like, no, it's done away since the British days. And I'm like, okay. So I've always kept that story in the back of my mind. And last year, I saw an article in the SCMP with statistics backing it up, and thus I did my own story about it. So there are government statistics that show that women are paid 14% less than men here. And as the ages increase, that gap increases. And when you start out, like when you're 15 to 19, there's actually a 2% pay gap. So that's quite worrying, right? And I think people just don't realize that this is happening, actually. I think because it's illegal. You can't say this is a male, this is a man, and this is a woman, I'm going to pay him more. So it's actually illegal here. But it happens. In my story, I did research, and I was talking to a recruiter. And he says, well, when men get a new job, they're already looking for the next job. So they're going to make a move within 2 years, probably. And every time you make a move, you're looking at a 10% pay rise. Whereas women who are more likely to stay at their company, they, if they're lucky, they're getting a raise about 2% every year. So that already folds in the situation of the gender pay gap, right? So I think women just are not aware that this is happening.
I'd like to add to that. I think it became a huge deal in the U.S. because of the tsunami triggered by all these revelations about Harvey Weinstein, who is not only a very famous person, he's a very famous Hollywood producer, not only a famous person in his own right, but the victims who came forward were celebrities, they were movie stars, they were people, women who everybody knew and looked up to, and their stories were not about pay gaps, which, you know, that's bread and butter, but it's not sexy. The stories were more about how they were attacked by this very powerful man, how they were raped by this very powerful man, and the stories were just so lurid that they not only lingered in the public consciousness, but snowballed. And and Me Too became a rallying cry in the U.S. mostly for my sense was not so much how women are treated in terms of salaries, but how women were objectified and subject to violence in the workplace and beyond.
The question is, how did you get involved, each of you, in the book?
Okay. Rita Lee was a former colleague. Rita Lee is the collecting editor. This was her project during COVID. So she contacted me, because I've lived in Singapore for like almost 20 years before I moved here. And as I said, she was my colleague. We worked together in MSN. And she said, I want to put together a book and have writers, female writers around the region. Do you know anyone in Hong Kong? I told her, I know people in Manila and in Hong Kong. Funny enough, she didn't have any Filipino journalists in the book, but she had, what I had done was contacted AAJA and asked them, does anybody want to contribute? And Zella and Caitlin and I think Valencia, who's now in the US, both responded and they contributed, and I, you know, connected them with Rita, and that's how the book came together.
How do you turn your, this is a very Brené Brown question, right? How do you turn your vulnerability into a strength in a male-dominated workplace as a young female journalist?
All right, I'll take a stab at your question. So last year I was given a very big project, the largest English language project for my network. And it's something that we've done for 20 years, actually. So my company, the foundation arm of my company would give these $1.2 million to international scientists around the world. And it used to be a project that was headed up by two senior journalists, and they'd fly them around to do this, right? During COVID, we didn't fly anymore. We did it via Zoom. So I started the first year via Zoom, and I did this with my boss at the time. But last year, there was no more COVID, and I was given the entire project. So this is brand new to me, because suddenly I'm asked to go to the US. I was going to 10 different cities in 15 days. I was going to Australia. I had to add this element of, it was just a very, very, very complicated project. So people, everybody in the newsroom had done this project before had all left, actually. They'd moved on, they'd retired, they'd moved to different companies, they'd immigrated, went back to Canada. But I stayed in good contact with them. So I was literally like WhatsApping them every day, like, what do I do here? They're like, Zella, your travel agent is going to help you. I was like, no, things have changed. I need to do this myself. Or like, how do I learn this material? I'm learning like, you know, top level science. People go on to win Nobel Prizes. How do I understand this material? And really, those mentors helped me through that project. And it went off well. I was very lucky. I feel very grateful that I was able to spend 3 to 4 months doing this big project for the company. And at the end of it, I got a promotion. So I was super grateful. So I think I managed to answer your question, right? Because I didn't know. I didn't know how to do that. But I had people who were willing to help me.
I'd like to broaden your question, if I may. I think the vulnerability that women face, in particular women journalists, is not in the day-to-day, probably the biggest career vulnerability, just based on my observations as well as experiences, is childbearing. It's actually a little bit better, I suspect, here in Hong Kong, because it's not only acceptable, but it's accessible, very flexible childcare in the form of affordable helpers. It's part of the law. Everybody, you know, most families, middle class and above, have helpers to assist with childcare. It is a mess. It is so hard in US and most countries. Some of the most successful female journalists have been the ones with families, the ones with children, were able to do it despite having children. And if you probe a bit, they only have one child, and they have a stay-at-home husband, or they have a grandmother, you know, the journalist mother who stayed home with the kids and so forth. And the others, a lot of them have no children or they're not even married because the nature of the job, the news cycle doesn't stop, you know, when the daycare centers close. So it not only leads women to drop out, female journalists to drop out of the workplace, but it causes, in my observations, many women journalists to self-limit what they do. They don't seek the foreign assignments. They, you know, they want the desk jobs with the predictable hours.
Caitlin, I suspect you've given us another topic for another panel because you really, I think, have said something that's very resonant to many of us who have left journalism and why. However, we are out of time. So thank you so much, Caitlin Liu, Gervina Lau, and Anzela Chen. Thank you so much for your thoughts.
Thanks for listening to The Correspondent, made right here downstairs at the FCC in Hong Kong. And don't forget, The Stories Women Journalists Tell, a book edited by Rita Lee, is out right now from Penguin Random House.
And don't forget also, you can find us on all your usual social media platforms. Just search for FCC Hong Kong. I'm sure you can find us. And don't forget, you can access our entire video archive of lunchtime panels and special guests. And with the 10th anniversary of the missing Malaysia Airlines flight, a video of that has got another 20, 30,000 views. That's very interesting listening. There's Michael Palin talking Monty Python, former Hong Kong Governor Chris Patten, and of course, Nobel Prize winner Maria Ressa, among many others. Just search for FCC Hong Kong on YouTube. Zela Chin, once again, thank you kindly.
Thank you, Jared Watt. Bye for now.